You're listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. Due to the temporary closure of in-station activity at KBOO, board meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available on our website. The KBOO Board of Directors meets the fourth Monday of the month starting at 6 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify if a meeting is being held.
From KPFK Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. In today's news headlines, a day before President-elect Joe Biden takes office, there are a flurry of cabinet nominee confirmation hearings to rush through, ensuring that critical positions are filled during the presidential transition. There are five nominees being vetted by lawmakers: Lloyd J. Austin III as Defense Secretary, Anthony J. Blinken for State Secretary, Janet Yellen to head the Treasury Department, Alejandro N. Mayorkas for Homeland Security Secretary, and Avril D. Haines for the position of National Intelligence Director. Responding to questions about raising the federal minimum wage, Treasury nominee Janet Yellen said this on Tuesday.
They're suffering in countless ways, especially during this pandemic, and really struggling to get by. And raising the minimum wage would really help many of those workers.
Ms. Yellen pushed lawmakers to be aggressive about stimulating the failing U.S. economy during her hearing. National Intelligence nominee Avril Haines, during her opening remarks, stressed the importance of keeping intelligence gathering and dissemination free of politics, and also took an aggressive posture on China.
To safeguard the integrity of our intelligence community, the DNI must insist that when it comes to intelligence, there is simply no place for politics ever. We should provide the necessary intelligence to support long-term bipartisan efforts to outcompete China, gaining and sharing insight into China's intentions and capabilities, while also supporting more immediate efforts to counter Beijing's unfair, illegal, aggressive, and coercive actions, as well as its human rights violations, whenever we can.
That's Avril Haines during her Senate confirmation hearing as Director of National Intelligence on Tuesday. The anti-war group Code Pink has denounced Haines as a, quote, torture apologist and drone lover. Alejandro Mayorkas, as Homeland Security nominee, also addressed lawmakers. As a son of Cuban immigrants, Mayorkas was Deputy Secretary of Homeland Security under President Obama, and during his opening statement expressed his horror at the Capitol riot on Tuesday.
The love for this country that I learned from my parents only made the January 6th attack on our Capitol all the more horrifying. If I should have the honor of being confirmed, I will do everything I can to ensure that the tragic loss of life, the assault on law enforcement, the desecration of the building that stands as one of the three pillars of our democracy, the terror that you felt, your colleagues, staff, and everyone present, will not happen again.
That's Alejandro Mayorkas facing Senate confirmation as Joe Biden's Homeland Security Secretary on Tuesday. Biden's team announced an ambitious plan to overhaul the nation's immigration system in a proposal that he plans to send to Congress on Wednesday, his very first day in office. The proposed bill includes border enforcement, but also an expansion of the U.S.'s refugee programs that were heavily curtailed under the current administration, And most importantly, it includes an 8-year path to citizenship for the nation's roughly 11 million undocumented immigrants. Mr. Biden has also made history with his pick for Secretary of Health and Human Services. Rachel Levine, who is currently Pennsylvania's health secretary, would be the nation's first transgender person to lead HHS if she is confirmed. In another decision warmly welcomed by progressives, news broke that Biden was planning to end the Keystone XL pipeline project upon taking office. A Gallup poll published Tuesday found that nearly 70% of Americans approve of the way Mr. Biden is handling his transition to the presidency, not as high as Barack Obama, but higher than Donald Trump. As federal troops provide security for Wednesday's inauguration ceremony, two Army National Guard members were removed from duty over their ties to far-right groups. The New York Times also reported that the Pentagon is intensifying efforts to identify and combat white supremacy and other far-right extremism in its ranks, as federal investigators seek to determine how many military personnel and veterans joined the violent assault on the Capitol. Meanwhile, the FBI is warning that Trump-supporting QAnon conspiracists may be posing as National Guard members to try to infiltrate the inauguration security. As Washington, D.C. is blanketed in troops and other federal law enforcement, expected violence over the weekend did not transpire. At state houses around the country where protests and potentially violent actions were expected, there were only small gatherings after security was beefed up. Efforts to round up, arrest, and charge rioters who attacked the Capitol on January 6th continue, as Thomas Edward Caldwell, a leader of the Oath Keepers militia from Virginia, has now become the first to face a conspiracy charge. Another two members of the same group from Ohio, Jessica Watkins and Donovan Crowell, also face charges. Newly seated Republican lawmaker and Trump supporter Lauren Boebert faces accusations from fellow representatives that she gave a tour of the Capitol to a large group of visitors just before the riot. Meanwhile, former Attorney General William Barr and Trump loyalist admitted that the questioning of the 2020 election results, quote, precipitated the riot, but he refused to blame Trump directly, even though it was the president who led the charges and directed his supporters to the Capitol. Former Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, still the Senate's top-ranking Republican, found it within him to finally say, quote, the mob was fed lies. They were provoked by the president and other powerful people. No other high-ranking elected official enabled President Trump for the past 4 years more than Mr. McConnell. A new poll shows support for convicting Trump in a Senate impeachment trial may be slowly increasing. About 20% of Republican voters now believe that Trump should be held responsible. 86% of Democrats feel the same way. Mr. Trump's final day in office is expected to be filled with issuing pardons and commutations. He is likely to not issue a self-pardon after being advised that it would make him appear guilty. The New York Times on Sunday published a damning report showing that Trump lawyer Rudy Giuliani was essentially selling pardons for about $2 million apiece to anyone who could afford them. As the COVID-19 death toll approaches 400,000, Americans are extremely worried about the ongoing pandemic, as a Washington Post ABC poll concludes. According to the Post, quote, large majorities of people of all political affiliations say they think the deadly virus is only somewhat under control or not at all controlled. California, the nation's most populous state, also has the largest number of infections and now may be the site of a newly identified virus mutation different from the one first identified in the UK. It is not yet clear if this new mutation is more transmissible or less affected by the new vaccines. Incoming President Joe Biden's pandemic plan, dubbed maddeningly obvious by one commentator, has been warmly welcomed by states that have had to struggle on their own without federal leadership for the past year. Finally, in international news, 10 years after a revolution that sparked the Arab Spring, mass protests are engulfing Tunisia once more. The Washington Post summarized how, quote, a fresh generation of Tunisian youth is protesting economic woes, social inequality, political corruption, and other problems driven by the unfulfilled expectations of a revolution that toppled their dictator. The protests were organized in the wake of the 10th anniversary of the uprising last week. And that does it for our news headlines. We'll be back with the rest of the show after this break. KPFK Pacifica Radio. This is Rising Up at Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica Radio stations and affiliates nationwide. It is hard to believe that the 4 years of the Trump presidency are finally coming to an end. A collective trauma exacerbated by a deadly pandemic and economic collapse, culminating in a violent invasion of the Capitol, has left Americans reeling. White supremacist violence is resurgent after Twitter waited too long to silence its chief proponent, Donald Trump. 4 years ago, I spoke with our news correspondent, Arun Gupta, who had rightly predicted the ethos of ethnic cleansing that was at the heart of the Trump administration. Here is Arun in April 2017, speaking with me in studio to assess the first 100 days of the worst presidency in history.
He's clearly completely incompetent. He's petty. He's a bully. But I've been saying for a year also the guy is a genius. You know, he's a genius at manipulating the media, people's emotions, and being a demagogue. But when it comes to actually running the Oval Office, I mean, you know, he said about healthcare. Who could imagine that it was so complicated? It's right. That's why there's, you know, tens of thousands of lawyers and policy experts. None of them imagined it could be so complicated. He said the same thing after he met with President Xi of China. You know, who thought North Korea was so complicated? Well, actually, there's a whole foreign policy and national security establishment, you know, that's been dealing with this issue for 60 years. He's very much making it up as he goes along. And my worry is you know, at this point, I'm starting to feel like, look, we've seen this movie before. There is one big plot twist, a different plot twist this time. With the Bush administration, it was planned incompetence. I think that was kind of the overarching style of the Bush administration, that, you know, especially we saw with the occupation of Iraq and Hurricane Katrina, that there was incompetence was part of their planning ideology. Here what we have is planned craziness.
That's Arun Gupta in 2017 on our program, assessing the first 100 days of the Trump presidency. Arun is an investigative journalist who's written for The Washington Post, The Nation, The Intercept, Raw Story, The Guardian, and Jacobin. He's also a regular news correspondent for our program. And he joins me once more as we mark the end of the Trump presidency. Welcome back, Arun.
Thanks, Sonali. I wasn't sure we were ever going to see this day.
That's right. Let's first talk about your feelings of what you said 4 years ago and whether that planned craziness you referred to was one common and constant theme over the past 4 years.
I think it very much is. You know, what defines Trumpism in a lot of ways is, sure, it's the ethnic cleansing, the authoritarianism, the white nationalism. I think at this point we can finally say, yeah, it's fascism. I've been saying it for years. Now, after the Capitol Hill coup on January 6th, the coup attempt, you now see the mainstream media kind of grudgingly admit, well, maybe he is a fascist. But it's the sadism, you know, just that type of deliberate cruelty that the Trump administration practiced as a policy, just as to be almost as insane as possible. You know, it's the children's concentration camps. It's these horrifying refugee camps that, you know, was just a year ago that I was down there talking to you from that refugee camp in Matamoros, which has just become absolutely hellish. It's the cruelty that we've seen with the COVID-19 pandemic, just the deliberately botched response at every level, now including the vaccine rollout. So, you know, it is this kind of contradictory phenomena of it's crazy, but it is planned. In other words, there is a rationality to it.
You had said about a year ago, less than a year ago, when the pandemic was first declared, that this would mark the end of the Trump presidency. And were it not for the pandemic, we very likely would have seen a re-election of Trump because the stock market was booming and the rich were doing quite well. Do you stand by that?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, the stock market was booming and the rich were doing quite well. But let's not also forget that the Trump administration was essentially using Keynesian economics. They were pouring huge amounts of money into the economy at large. And part of that was a deal that Trump had struck with Pelosi and Schumer. You know, they were trying to keep certain levels of social support up. So Trump was happy to be funding things like food stamps, even as the Republicans in Congress were trying to cut it. So you had this kind of like weird mix of like, you know, huge increases in military spending, which do flow through a lot of the economy because so much of the production is domestic and because you have millions of people who are on the payroll of the military. Then also these massive like giveaways to the agricultural industry, which were a result of his terrible agricultural policies that resulted in huge losses for agribusiness farmers in the U.S. And then along with the social spending, it was keeping the economy at a red hot pace. And then the other side was, you know, let's not let go of the fact that Biden ran a pretty terrible campaign. And he did many of the unforced errors that Hillary Clinton did in 2016, such as not opening field offices, such as spending vast amounts of sum on television advertising instead of get out the vote. They did the exact same thing with the Latino community as in 2016, where they thought like, where their attitude, it wasn't even thinking, it was like, oh, we're just gonna say Trump's racist and that'll be good enough. And Biden barely won, right? And he barely won because of the horrifying toll of the pandemic, the deaths, the economic damage, the fact that a lot of people were mobilized, and also that activists in key states saved his bacon, such as in Georgia, such as in, you know, Latino organizers and LGBTQ organizers in Arizona, such as the Culinary Workers Union in Nevada. No, these are the ones who kept those states in Biden's column or flipped them, as in the case of Jordan Stacey Abrams. So he nearly lost despite the pandemic. So Trump would have cruised to easy victory if it were not for the pandemic.
So we also know that the last 4 years of the Trump presidency especially have laid bare the racist and white supremacist foundations of the United States, built upon them. White supremacy is resurgent. Trump certainly didn't invent it. He unleashed it and maybe emboldened far more people to sort of join this white supremacist movement. We see so many reports of, you know, former Obama voters and supporters who are now QAnon conspiracists who helped the riot on the Capitol. You know, and I'm wondering if you think that had Trump not had Fox News and the, you know, universe of right-wing media outlets echoing his claims, or Twitter to amplify his views, would we have seen what we saw over the last 4 years? If he had only at his disposal the traditional modes of getting the word out, you know, whitehouse.gov, press conferences where media would question his press secretary, if he only had those traditional modes of communication, would we have seen what we saw over the past 4 years?
You're absolutely right. It is kind of One is the development of the right-wing echo chamber that goes back to the 1990s, and two is new mediums, right? And demagogues, successful demagogues, are very good at manipulating new mediums because people really aren't familiar with them as they existed before. So Hitler was, you know, really skilled. The Nazis were really skilled at using film. Father Coughlin, the American quasi-fascist during the Great Depression, he was really skilled at using radio. And Twitter did allow Trump this one-to-one communication with his vast audience, and which the world was indeed hanging on. But it gave him both this huge audience and a sense of intimacy with his individual supporters. And I do want to address one point that I think is absolutely important, because we hear it all the time and still hear it all the time, is this notion that Trump is just exposing what already existed. And I think that's basically a real lazy way of thinking of what's going on. And you mentioned the Capitol. Obama supporters, one of the notable ones there was Kevin Greeson. He's the man who had the heart attack. You know, there are reports that he tased himself to death. They haven't been confirmed. But he was a vice president of his union at Goodyear in Alabama. He went to Obama's inauguration in 2008. And so in this short time, just 12 years, he goes from an Obama supporter, someone who backs progressive causes, a union official, to becoming a crazed QAnon follower in Trump's army.
And Ashley Babbitt, I understand, the woman killed by Capitol Police, was also an Obama supporter initially.
Yes, apparently she was, that she voted for Obama in 2008 as well. So the thing is, Trump is creating something new, and we have to understand that consciousness can change. And if you don't believe consciousness can change, then you might as well give up.
We're all in trouble then.
Well, exactly. And the thing is also, just look at yourself. You know, I'm using the generic you. I mean, certainly yeah. Me, my consciousness changed dramatically when I became politically radicalized in college. And then it changed again, moving to New York City, in terms of getting out of white suburbia into a much different environment. So Trump really changed a consciousness, and we have to change it back. And there are things that we can do. So for instance, there needs to be severe prosecutions of these coup plotters, because that's a thing that we've seen the last 5 years, you know, that it's the impunity that the right enjoys. We're now in the 5-year anniversary of the Bundy occupation. They enjoyed impunity. They got off without any jail time from two different trials. And that led directly into the impunity of Patriot Prayer, Proud Boys, Adam Waffen, the militias of the last 4 years. And that sense of impunity is what fueled this attempted insurrection. So there needs to be serious prosecutions. We don't need new laws. We don't need new police powers. We just need the laws that exist to be enforced. The second part is we need to give people a stake in the system, and that means give them universal health care, taxpayer-funded higher education, a Green New Deal, you know, living wage, housing that is safe and affordable. We need to give people a stake in the system, and we can do that, and I think that would reduce a lot of the kind of right-wing mass longing for violence. You'll still be left with the hardcore violent extremists. But the problem is, what do we do about Fox News? What do we do about social media?
I want to pick up on what you were
Twitter
saying.
Twitter finally shut down Trump.
I want to pick up on what you're saying with the impunity mm-hmm. before we get back to the issue of right-wing media. I mean, you see a lot of these Trump supporters who were sort of seem flabbergasted that there are warrants out for their arrest, directly appealing to Trump for a pardon. And interestingly enough, you know, you have to think, if the House had not impeached Trump for insurrection, for incitement of insurrection, Trump would be having to, you know, would very likely be issuing those pardons. Now he's in a position where on his last day of his presidency, if he issues pardons to these people who are his followers, he directly implicates himself and risks a Senate conviction in an impeachment trial. And if it weren't for that, he wouldn't have had to pay that price. That sense of accountability that an impeachment brings with it is critical. And you know, the House had 4 long years to impeach him for many other issues. They had this one impeachment on, well, 2 articles of impeachment on a very narrow part of his presidency on the Ukraine scandal. And of course, the Senate acquitted him. Now we're seeing former Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell even admit that Trump was responsible for the attack on the Capitol. And it just seems just tragic that it had to get to the point where lawmakers were personally threatened before some of them could see that Trump needed to be held accountable at the very, very last minute of his presidency.
Yeah, but even then, a majority of the Republican caucus in the House still backed his bogus election claims. They, you know, and this is the what we exist in, right? You know, that he still has control over the party. You know, as now that we're 2 weeks on, the polling data shows the rank and file Republicans are still lockstep behind Trump. And the only way to, I think, break this fever is to show them that there is a price to pay for their actions. And, you know, I think we've all seen that video of that woman, Elizabeth from Tennessee, who was shocked that she would be maced. She's like, I stepped 1 foot inside the Capitol and I was maced. And then she's asked, why are you here? And she's just like, duh. We're here for a revolution. You know, it's that sense of white supremacy. It goes beyond white privilege, right? It's this white supremacy that they can do anything they want and get away with it. So the only way that they're going to think twice is if they start going away to jail for 10, 20, 30 years. And again, I want to be clear, this is not a call for new repressive powers, new domestic laws. It's to enforce laws against these criminals, because that's all they are.
And treat them the same way, like treat them the same way that the rest of us are treated, right? If they really were Antifa, how would the government treat them?
Well, then there'd be hundreds of dead around the Capitol.
Right, that's true. And that's certainly not what we want.
As
you were saying about Twitter and Fox News.
Mm-hmm. Well, they're still going to exist. And you know, the way we need to approach things is not, I think, to complain about why something the way it is. It's to understand why it is the way it is. And the way it is Fox News is still going to see great benefit. That means profits, audience, and power in stoking conflict, in spreading conspiracy theories, in encouraging divisiveness and hatred. Now, part of it is it's trying to play catch up in the last few years. But when you have so much of the Republican base that has basically, you know, I don't want to say crazy, because the whole point of QAnon is, I think it's really about showing fealty to the leader, right? If you can believe that there's this, you know, global cult of Satan worshiping pedophiles who also eat children, who run the world, you will believe anything. You can do anything. So Fox News helped bring this into being, but they're also trying to play catch up. You know, they can't suddenly become the QAnon channel. I'm actually surprised that some right-wing billionaire hasn't launched a QAnon channel, realizing the amount of money that they can make. But they're going to keep encouraging it. Trump's going to keep encouraging it. And as we see from the House Republicans, you know, the House is the most representative body at the federal level in the United States. There are plenty of Republicans who see a political advantage, a power advantage, a celebrity advantage, a monetary advantage to keep stoking this conflict. And I think we are in, you know, likely in an era of kind of low-level terrorism. It's not civil war. I think we need to like reject that language. But I think we're going to see more bombings, like the Nashville bombings, like Oklahoma City. We're going to see more political mass shootings, like the Tree of Life Synagogue, like El Paso Walmart, Gilroy Garlic Festival, and perhaps also attempted political assassinations. You know, it's not a pretty future, but we have to figure out what to do about this ideological apparatus that encourages this extremism.
Finally, briefly, the Biden incoming Biden administration's flurry of actions and also nominees to head certain departments, top agencies and departments, does that promise for you a step in the right direction, or are you worried that Biden might run his presidency like he ran his campaign?
I mean, I think we're kind of seeing like contradictory signals. You know, the fact that he did endorse a $2 trillion a relief bill, but at the same time, they're not playing hardball with the Republican Senate. You know, they're agreeing to essentially a power sharing agreement where they could run roughshod over him. But the problem is that they also have members, their own rank and file, especially Joe Manchin from West Virginia, who could completely turn on them. He's basically a Republican. And if he were to flip, the Republicans would be back in charge of the Senate. So I want to be cautiously optimistic, but this is a Democratic establishment we're talking about, who are just... basically, you know, as I've been saying, it's a neoliberal corpse that's in charge of the party and the presidency now.
Well, Arun, I want to thank you, as always, for joining us. We shall certainly have you back on to talk about the first 100 days of the Biden presidency. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Sonali.
My guest has been Arun Gupta, investigative journalist who's written for The Washington Post, The Nation, The Intercept, Raw Story, The Guardian, and Jacobin. He's also a regular news correspondent for Rising Up with Sonali. We've been discussing the end of the Trump presidency. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RUWithSonali. KPFK Pacifica Radio. This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica Radio stations and affiliates nationwide. As the United States transitions to a new presidency, attempting to put 4 years of Donald Trump behind us, Mr. Joe Biden has a flurry of initial actions planned, including rejoining the Paris Accords and putting an end to the Keystone XL pipeline project. But according to my next guest, climate action needs to be rooted in local actions and policy, and most importantly, in justice. Shalanda Baker is a professor at the Northeastern School of Law. Before joining Northeastern's faculty, she spent 3 years as an associate professor of law at the William S. Richardson School of Law at the University of Hawaii, where she was the founding director of the Energy Justice Program. In 2016, she won a Fulbright Award and spent a year in Mexico exploring energy reform, climate change, and indigenous rights. She now joins me to discuss her new book, Revolutionary Power, an activist's guide to the energy transition. Welcome to the program, Shalanda.
Thank you so much, Sonali.
So as we are transitioning to a Biden presidency, on the broad federal level, do you see hope on the horizon, especially as compared to the 4 years of Trump when we are talking about climate change and even climate justice?
Sonali, there is no comparison. I mean, we're talking about night and day. So we think about the Trump administration, it was very much a systematic dismantling of environmental protections for communities of color, most notably, you know, waiving requirements for polluters right in the middle of the pandemic, even when we were beginning to learn more about how exposure to air pollution made it more likely that you were going to suffer, you know, bleak consequences as a result of COVID-19. So the Trump administration has taken a very cynical approach to environmental protection and very much driven by profit and driven by sort of, you know, again, rollbacks. The New York Times itself did an analysis and found over 100 different regulatory rollbacks in that administration. And so as we turn the page to the Biden administration, you know, we're already seeing with some of his top picks a very different approach, starting with Michael Regan, the head of the EPA, you know, a Black policymaker from North Carolina, which I should say is where the environmental justice movement really took off, in Warren County. And so, you know, that signals his appointment, and again, it needs to be Senate confirmed, his appointment really signals a shift in terms of how we're thinking about environmental issues. I think similarly, setting up a climate czar, if you will, in Gina McCarthy, and she will be right at the White House driving climate policy. That signals a real attention to climate change as an issue. And Gina obviously comes out of the EPA. She's now going to be the outgoing president of, or president and CEO of the Natural Resources Defense Council. So she really has the technical chops to drive climate policy. She was one of the architects of the Clean Power Plan under the Obama administration. And as her deputy, she has Ali Zaidi, who comes out of New York. New York is a leading state in terms of climate policy. Just last summer, Governor Cuomo signed into law the Community Leadership and Climate Leadership and Community Protection Act, which really makes a commitment to frontline environmental justice communities. And so I think with this team that also includes John Kerry as an external international climate envoy, we're really set up for success. And I would be remiss without mentioning the Council on Environmental Quality, which is where a lot of the environmental justice work in the administration happens. And we have Brenda Mallory, who is coming from the Southern Environmental Law Center, really driving and leading a lot of initiatives there. And she's a veteran to government work. And one of her key deputies there will be Cecilia Martinez, who I think of as the mother of the environmental justice movement. If that long answer didn't give you any clue, I'll just put a fine point on it. And that is, you know, we're headed in a vastly different direction with this new administration.
You write in your book that your main objective, quote, is to model an approach of justice first in pursuit of averting catastrophic climate change rather than one of climate first, justice later. What do you mean by that? What have you been worried about in seeing the approach to tackling climate change?
Yeah. So, Sonali, I'll answer that question by giving an example and an anecdote from my own background and my own life story. So I left practice as a corporate lawyer way back in 2009 and found myself in 2010 in January living in Oaxaca, Mexico, which is very much ground zero for Mexico's energy transition. And when I say energy transition, I'm talking about the transition away from fossil fuels to clean energy. And so when I got to Oaxaca, I actually met indigenous peoples who were fighting against mega wind, massive wind development. And as I dug into that issue, I realized that they were being dispossessed, displaced, divided, not to use too many D words, but you know, all of the bad things that we connect to fossil fuel and fossil fuel development were happening in Oaxaca. And Oaxaca, again, is a remarkable place for any of your viewers out there. I recommend it. But it's also home to no fewer than 14 distinct indigenous groups. It's one of the poorest places in Mexico. And the place where all of this wind energy development was taking place is called the Isthmus of Tehuantepec. And it's a small stretch of land that happens to be one of the windiest places on Earth. And so starting from my time in 2010 to now, we've seen an exponential growth of wind energy development there, and very much a grassroots indigenous movement against that development because they're simply not benefiting from it. And now Oaxaca has the proud distinction of being a place with one of the highest, if not the highest concentration of onshore wind energy in the world. And again, that type of dense development, extractive development, that is not benefiting them at all. And so I had the opportunity, as you mentioned in lead up and in my bio, that to go down to Mexico in 2016 to serve as a Fulbright scholar. And, you know, I was there to really look at and explore and do research connected to the transition, Mexico's transition. They just opened up their markets to private investments for the first time in over 100 years. And, you know, I had the opportunity to sit down with a policymaker who was at the equivalent of the Department of Energy, but in Mexico. And I said, what are we going to do? You know, how are you going to address these social and environmental issues related to this transition? And you're running over the rights of indigenous peoples in this development. And he said, Shalanda, climate change. We have to do this because climate change is an emergency. And so again, this is a mentality of let's avert climate change first and then worry about issues of equity. But what is lost in that analysis is the understanding that the very people that you're sort of running over in your race to avert catastrophic climate change are the ones who are on the front lines who will receive the very worst impacts of the climate emergency. And so I argue in the book that we should be centering those communities and centering their concerns in this transition.
So are you worried that the same structures and the same institutions that have fomented climate change are going to be handed the reins of getting us out of this crisis and therefore leave out the issue of justice and human rights? I mean, we see even fossil fuel companies and financial institutions, you know, sort of come late to the party and decided that they are now going to work toward addressing climate change, of course, in the hopes of making money from it. But that may be a massive, that may, you know, be fraught with pitfalls.
It is absolutely fraught with pitfalls. And I think we need to be really careful about who we empower in this transition. And I think we need to interrogate the structures that we have come to except as a natural part of the fabric. And by structures, I mean our approaches to energy policy, our approaches to electricity rate making, as well as our approaches to, you know, the types of actors that we're relying on to shepherd us, you know, out of this dark place with, you know, the heavy reliance on fossil fuels to clean energy. And I, you know, very skeptically view, you know, the fossil fuel industry as it attempts to sort of change hats, you know, in this new moment. So I think you're absolutely right to voice some skepticism on your end and also cynicism even with respect to the types of actors that we're relying on. And so I would argue that, again, all of it is on the table. We know that we have a legal system that is rife with inequality. We know that there's so much structural inequality all around us. And I would connect the struggle for, you know, racial justice within the criminal justice system to the struggle for racial justice within the energy system. You know, no part of our society has been spared by structural inequality. So it follows that our electricity system and that our energy system are similarly burdened by racial injustice.
Tell me about your time in Port Arthur, Texas, which you write about in your book, and how that is in many ways an example of the environmental racism we have seen, and can offer a guide to how climate change needs to focus on justice.
Right. So Port Arthur, Texas is the birthplace of the modern fossil fuel industry, as well as its current spine and epicenter. It's also a low-income Black and Latinx community, and it is a part of what is broadly referred to as the Golden Triangle, which is to say that on a satellite image, you see lights lighting up this particular part of the Texas-Louisiana border area. And that area is lit up because of all the petrochemical and fossil fuel facilities that are concentrated in this particular place. It's also been called Cancer Alley, because in many ways it is what we would call in the environmental justice community a sacrifice zone. So that place has been sacrificed in order to provide cheap energy to the rest of us in this country. It also happens to be the place where my father grew up. And my father worked in the electricity sector for the local utility. My grandfather worked for, I think, Chevron. My uncles also worked for the oil industry. And so it is both the benefactor as well as the thing that has made life for people in that area so difficult from an environmental standpoint. We have cancer rates that are higher there. We have all sorts of other maladies that are high due to their status as an environmental justice community. And so I had the opportunity to spend a little bit of time there when I was around 8 years old. And I took it, my parents were split, so I had a chance to go down with my sister. And we spent a summer there, and I really got to know that place. I fell in love with it. It was, you know, for me, such a foreign land. I grew up in Austin, which is very urban, and Port Arthur is semi-rural in some ways, and it's on the bayou, and there's a fishing culture, so people are crabbing and fishing and eating fried fish for dinner, and the accents are different. I mean, I couldn't understand anything going on half the time, but I fell in love with it. And as I pulled back many, many years later, I mean, I'm talking about in the last couple years, and really began to dive into my work on energy justice and environmental justice, I realized that Port Arthur is so crucial to our nation's energy story. And I'll give you one stark example that was very much my entry point into Port Arthur as a study. Back in 2017, I was, you know, fastidiously following all of the news and developments around Hurricane Harvey. And, you know, late one night, I was scrolling through the New York Times, and there was a Facebook Live video posted, and a young man was on the video saying, "Help us, please help us. We are in knee deep water. We need help. We need help." And this was a young man from Port Arthur. And that young man happened to be my half brother. So that was the moment where it hit me that I have a stake in this transition, and I have commitments based on where I come from. To tell these stories.
You write that utilities reform is the linchpin to transforming the energy system. And in addition to Mexico, in addition to Port Arthur, Hawaii and the state of Hawaii is a very important model for climate justice, but also, you know, showcase how that whole struggle unfolded. Tell me about what Hawaii can teach us, you know, for those who are lucky enough to have traveled there. One thing jumps out at people, which is that rooftop solar is almost everywhere on mm-hmm. any of the islands. Many of the islands have you know, homes that are just dotted with solar on their rooftops, which could be the case in many more states around the nation, but isn't. Why?
Right. So Sonali, I love that you read the book and found it so compelling. It's like, yes, that was the goal, to really make, you know, these technical energy topics come alive, and for the stakes of our transition to really become tangible to the reader. And so I had the privilege and honor to go to Hawaii in 2014, and I joined the faculty at the University of Hawaii School of Law. And I got there at a really exciting time. So as you say, Sonali, rooftop solar was everywhere. And at that time, there was about, I think there were about 17% of all of residents there had rooftop solar. So that's almost one in five. It's extraordinary. It was the highest rate of solar adoption in the country at that time. And so at the same time, the utility was pushing up against that and saying, whoa, 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 this is too much distributed energy generation, because that rooftop solar was taking away from their ability to, you know, their bottom line, essentially. You know, when you generate solar on your rooftop, you're getting a discount. You're selling your electricity back to the grid as opposed to having to pay the provider for your electricity. And this was cutting into the utility's profits. And so they're making a range of arguments, including that the grid was too unstable to allow for so much electricity going back into the grid. The grid was designed to push it out to homes. They were making the argument that rooftop solar hurt poor people because it was leaving them with the cost of maintaining the grid.
And this is an argument you hear over and over and over again, yeah, in so many different arenas. You know, here in California, where I am based, you hear any arguments usually pushed by corporate lobbyists that anything that is there to hurt them or their bottom line really is an insult to poor people and working people and people of color.
Well, here's what I would say in response in terms of the insults, right? Rooftop solar isn't the insult. The insult is placing fossil fuel generation in communities of color. Mm. The insult is the disproportionate burden that homes, low to moderate income homes, are paying for electricity. Our electricity rate design is regressive. That means the poorest people are paying more of their overall income to just keep the lights on. That's an insult. That's the issue that utilities should be tackling, rather than trying to end rooftop solar, which actually lowers emissions, if we think about it over a longer time horizon, in the very communities they say they care about. You know, that's my response to that. So it's a very sort of cynical, disingenuous approach. And so all of that was kind of happening in Hawaii. It was the preview to what we are seeing around the country. And for me, it was just like a kid in the candy store. What I realized, going back to your original question, is that utilities were at the heart of all of these debates. And they were at the heart of all of those debates because of their business model. They're incentivized to sell electricity. They're incentivized to build infrastructure, to build stuff. And the regulator in the state, and I'm making it sound like a soap opera because it really felt like a soap opera then. Mm-hmm. The regulator in the state, the Public Utilities Commission, said, utility, you are slow walking our clean energy transition. You must innovate, or you're going to be regulated out of existence. So either you can play a role in this transition or you need to step aside, because climate change is real. And, you know, distributed energy is something that we need for resilience and for a whole host of reasons. And so I got to witness that. And that's why utility justice and utility reform have become such a central part, I think, of my analysis regarding our energy transition and how to do that in a way that is just.
And of course, on the mainland here in the United States, you see, you know, many people who might love to have solar on their rooftops if they're lucky enough to be homeowners, or simply be able to draw their energy from solar and not have to live near, say, a fracking well, but simply don't have the money to make that happen because they're busy putting food on their table. So how can the Hawaii model be expanded to local communities, to utilities across the country, because it shouldn't be that cost prohibits people from being able to have rooftop solar.
You're absolutely right, Sonali. So there are three key ways people can get access to solar. They've got the savings and they can buy the solar panels outright. Okay. You know, we know who's privileged enough to do that, and we know kind of how wealth disparities have played out in this country. So that's not a lot of Black and Brown and Indigenous people. The second way is, you know, you can go to the bank and get a loan to have them buy the solar panels, and you pay off that loan.
Or there are companies that just lease it to you, which is what I did for my
home. That's the third way.
Oh, I see. Okay.
So the third way is the leasing model. And I think all of those ways or of accessing solar are kind of put on top of a society that is structurally unequal. And so, you know, the folks who are able to benefit from those particular models are not low to moderate income people, right, due to credit score and due to, you know, even access to banks, which we know redlining has made difficult in certain communities.
And all of them involve either going into debt or having, you know, large nest egg to invest into it.
Exactly. And so what I would say is that everyone pays their electricity bill, right? And studies have shown that this is one of the first bills that people pay, even when they're at the margins. We should use the electricity bill as a vehicle, as a mechanism to allow for on-bill financing of solar, which would mean, you know, the utility is essentially carrying that risk, and we could back up that risk. I mean, now I'm getting back into my corporate law kind of corporate finances, but we could sort of provide a backstop to that risk with things like green banks, which are, you know, sometimes formed by a legislature, sometimes formed by other capital investments. But, you know, there are ways to manage that risk. But we know that electricity and energy are fundamental human rights. And so we have to figure out a way to get broader access to that. And I should say that the disparity in solar access in communities of color isn't just for low to moderate income folks. It exists in middle income and higher income communities. And there's a racial component to this. I suspect that it's due in part to the largely white solar industry. I mean, there are reports and studies showing that the solar industry itself is not diverse. So we've got to diversify the solar industry. We've got to create not just jobs for installers, which is noble, and hopefully those are union jobs, but we need to create businesses that are owned by people of color so that they're seeding solar in their own communities.
So finally, there's so much more to talk about, but we're sort of limited by time, and I can certainly encourage people to read your book and you know, start to spread these ideas. When we think about the transition that needs to happen, do you worry that there's going to be far too much opposition to delivering what needs to be delivered as fast as possible without worrying about who it's impacting? And at the same time, we do have a pretty vibrant grassroots Black and brown and Indigenous-led movement now, more so than we did 10 years ago, demanding climate justice. You know, we have the call for a Green New Deal, which has, of course, been rejected as too radical. But, you know, just in terms of which path you think the United States will choose, especially under a President Joe Biden, what are your hopes or fears?
I have only hope. We're not going back. We are not going back. And, you know, the president has, Joe Biden has made a commitment to move 40% of all climate investments to frontline environmental justice communities. And I take him at his word to do that. And I think the folks who he has filled his administration with are committed to those goals and understand what's at stake in this transition. And so, you know, we're not going back in the same way we're not going back to accepting police violence against Black bodies and brown bodies. We're not going back to a world where people of color are on the wrong end of this transition. We can only move forward. And I have faith that it'll either happen in government or people on the ground will insist that it happens. So we're not going back.
Well, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. Shalonda, good luck with the book.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
Thank you. My guest has been Shalonda Baker, professor at the Northeastern School of Law. Before joining Northeastern's faculty, she spent 3 years as an associate professor of law at the William S. Richardson School of Law at the University of Hawaii, where she was a founding director of the Energy Justice Program. In 2016, she won a Fulbright Award and spent a year in Mexico exploring energy reform, climate change, and indigenous rights. We've been talking about her new book, Revolutionary Power, An Activist's Guide to the Energy Transition. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at Rising Up with Sonali. Sonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify.
Rising Up with Sonali is hosted, written, and executive produced by Sonali Kohatkar. Anna Bus is the producer, technical director, and web and social media supervisor. Our theme music is by Grammy Award-winning band Kitsap. Like us on Facebook.com/RUWithSonali. That's the letters RU with Sonali. And follow us on twitter.com/RUWithSonali. Our website is risingupwithsonali.com, where you can find all our programs archived and where you can get direct access to all our video and audio files.
Listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.